Welcome to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is a video game composer who has worked on games such as Little Big Planet, Tethered, Tearaway, and in my opinion, his magnum opus, which is Astrobot. I'd like to welcome Kenneth Young.
Hello. Thanks
or
for having
Kenny
me.
Or Kenny Young.
Yes. It's a good point. Like I always have to explain this. It's like I am definitely Kenny.
Yeah.
But the reason my credit is Kenneth CM, my two middle names, Young, is there's bizarrely what makes us Kenny and Young are two common names. Kenny Young is a composer who wrote Down on the Boardwalk. He passed away recently, so I think I'm sort of free from from his shadow. Bless him. And Kenneth Young's the conductor of the New Zealand Symphony. There's various Kenneth Youngs working in film sound and stuff like that. So yeah, it's my professional name.
Well, but it's a common name too, isn't it, Kenneth? So yeah, Kenny definitely. Kind of, you know, sounds a bit more hip.
But not Ken. English not people Ken. Love to call me Ken, and I don't know, it just doesn't. It's not Scottish. It's not Ken's very English. So slight chip on my shoulder
Ken,
about
then.
That.
Oh, I thought it would be best to start off with Astrobot, since that's the most recent one before we get into your other stuff. Because looking at it, it does feel like a combination of all of your work to date, everything that you've learned from your previous games to now. Would you agree with that notion?
Definitely. Yeah. Like I think that's probably true of any, your latest work has always got bits of something else in it, but there's some maybe obvious sort of touchstones there in terms of, for me, the things that I would say I can attach to other stuff is like, if you think about Little Big Planet, there was a lot of retro aesthetics in there. And in a way, that was how I first started getting into that. And there's quite a lot of retro stuff going on in Astrobot in terms of both like music production, trying to make stuff sound old. But then you get into the conceptual side of things, and of course, there's this whole like nostalgia vibe going on, which you could say the same thing was true of Little Big Planet. In some ways, it's quite a different kettle of fish because it wasn't trying to be so overtly gamey. But for me, Little Big Planet had this whole like 1970s, 1980s kids TV show kind of vibe. And that's what kind of pushed the retro aesthetics in that project. And then with Astrobot, it's the retro aesthetics are partly that's just my jam. And so any excuse to like, you know, push in like either 80s or 90s stuff or earlier, like there's some of the stuff that's quite 70s sounding. And occasionally I'll throw in a little bit of 50s or 60s stuff in there too, because why not? But then, of course, there's the PlayStation fan service, and that is intrinsically backwards looking, and so it kind of comes together and looks very intentional.
Well, it's so brilliant work.
There's that aspect, and then what else would I say? Yeah, I mean, and then the family friendly side of things is another obvious sort of touchstone, and that's very much my wheelhouse. That's like I'm the guy who does those things, and it's a good place to be because it's, the way I sort of look at it is it's quite a good personality match. Like I'm quite cheeky and sort of fun, playful sort. And I can't say I ever imagined I'd end up making these kinds of games, but, because I enjoy what I do. So it's obviously a happy marriage in that regard.
But you seem to touch on so many different sort of genres within the soundtrack and so many different instruments that you use, but it still sounds like the Kenny Young palette despite it going in all these different directions. So it's very cool what you've done.
Well, yeah, I think in some sort of ways, just to be totally honest, I think that's probably there's a unity you get from the like the writing style, like because I think my bag of tricks is probably quite narrow in that regard. And actually, one of the ways that I can get more breadth is by being a specialist in these different kind of retro aesthetics. And yeah, starting to sort of push myself off through necessity in a game like Astrobot, which has all these different gameplay mechanics that, as a result of that, have very different game level settings.
Mm.
And as a result of that, breadth needs different music genres, which is not normally asked of in your average game. Games tend to have a very fixed identity that then you kind of stick with that and roll it out across the IP. And I suppose there's obviously some similar things across the music that I write in Astrobot to sort of make it feel cohesive. But yeah, there are all these different genres in there. But yeah, I think that if you were to boil down my tracks and actually just sort of analyze them from like a music theory point of view, it's all quite simple stuff. Like there's I'm not really like a composer's composer. No one's like, oh my God, Kenny, those compositions, they're so sophisticated and esoteric. It's like, you know, it's poppy. It's quite simple in that regard. It's all diatonic writing. And that's just like I'm a fiddle player. I'm a violinist but that was my main instrument. So I've got a real affinity as a result, I think, with melody. But the other side of things, like harmony, like plonking on the piano, it's not like I'm not a piano player. Like, so I struggle with harmony. Like that's not my strength. I think you can hear that in the music.
But you're very good at melody.
Yeah.
Very good at melody.
Yeah. Like annoying melodies that get stuck in your head. It's like pleasure, pain.
Well, I don't know if I would call it annoying. If it gets stuck in your head, it's usually because it's catchy. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Which, of course, is sort of intentional. It's like the trick of the right amount of repetition, which, and again, everyone's different. So some people are completely down with that and love it and actually want that. And I think that that's definitely the direction I get is like, you know, we want the tunes to get stuck in people's heads. That's what we remember from our favorite gaming experiences when we were kids. So we're trying to like recreate that. And so, yeah, I'm the right guy for the job in that regard, which is great. And then some people, that's just a little bit too intense and a bit too much. And it can drive them a bit nuts. But, you know, you can't make a game that's really going to appeal to, you know, every single human being who's alive, unfortunately.
Totally. But one of the things that I find interesting is a lot of the older game composers that I've spoken to, when they were writing these tunes that were very melodic, they did it from a place of memory constraints, right? Because they had to write something that was only a minute long or something. In your case, you don't have to worry about that. But did Nick Doucet, for example, did he give you like a specific amount of time? Like, okay, if you're going to make a track, you have to make it within a 4 minute frame.
I mean budget starts to be probably the main limitation there, to be perfectly honest. But for me, just going back to my own experiences of creating music for family friendly platforming games, actually the family friendly bit is kind of irrelevant. It's the fact that if you are going to do these very strong melodies, basically pop song kind of format, musical structures, you can't really go with anything less than 3 minutes or it's too repetitive. And obviously the bigger a level gets, if you're getting to playing a track more than three times, like three is a magic number, so 3 minutes, three repetitions, if it goes beyond that, that's into like that's like probably annoying for your average person kind of amount of repetition.
Interesting.
That's like a rough rule of thumb, I would say, to go by. Three times three is like a good, nice limit to work with. And then if it goes beyond that, it's like, well, either we need to make the track longer so it loops less, or we want to switch the track up at some point in the level, maybe to, for whatever reason, in some kind of justified gameplay or context reason within the level that's going to make that make sense to the player, then, you need to look at that sort of thing.
Mm. And that, I suppose, it comes from playtesting. You'd know if
yes,
it needs
absolutely.
To be stretched.
It's all player experience
longer.
Based stuff. Yeah. You feel it, you know. And sometimes you think you've done a great job and everyone agrees and they sign off of it. And then, you know, 6 months later, they're like, this was great. But either the level's changed, right? Because that can happen too. And then it's like, this was great, but now we've changed it. The level's bigger. We need to readdress it. Or it's just like, we've been living with this and actually some people are starting, it's starting to get a bit annoying. So I think let's see what we can do to just to sort of tweak it a bit. But yeah, that team in particular, and Nico is like so focused on the player experience and of course wanting it to be fun and good, gives just the best feedback on that. And I really trust his opinion on whenever he's like, this isn't quite right. Like there's no like wiggle room there for like, nah, it's fine. Do you know what I mean?
It has like, to be good, yeah.
Yeah.
But, has to be great.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, a lot of this becomes mind games because you're sort of like, how could it have been fine and now it's not? But I think, yeah, you just have to sort of trust the person who's the, yeah, I mean, Nico signs off my work. So like, if he's not happy, then like it's got to try and fix that.
I did watch an old interview with him where he said that when he was doing the blue rooms or the early playtesting on the very first Astrobot game, they were using tracks from Little Big Planet just as
temp.
As a temp track, which I always found interesting. And then they were just like, well, we've got to get Kenny. We're just using his music.
I mean, that's kind of how, we first started working together. So Nico and I knew each other from our Sony London studio days. We didn't actually work together there, but I kind of knew Nico from like what I would call the Friday night drinking crew, basically. And just kind of, kept in touch. We were Facebook friends type thing. And then we'd see each other occasionally at industry conferences and, you know, catch up. And then he reached out and I think he was originally interested or was exploring the idea of having a licensed soundtrack in Astrobot Rescue Mission. So he was picking my brains about that process because he'd never done that before on any of his previous projects.
Right.
He just wanted to know about the kind of money involved, the time scales, and he's, you know, his background's in production, so he's just wanting to know about the process and the kind of money and stuff like that. And I just sort of spilt the beans on all that side of things and put him off that, which wasn't my intention because I wasn't thinking of it as, oh, here's an opportunity for me to sort of write some music. And actually, earlier in my freelance career, I'd written music for some of this Media Molecules projects, but I was never like the composer. I was, I was lead audio designer when I was first hired, and I ended up writing music on Little Big Planet. But that's not why I was hired. It just kind of fell into it for various reasons, and it worked out. And I wrote more stuff on Tearaway. But when I left and went freelance, I didn't know whether anyone would actually want to hire me as a composer. So that's when I did a couple of little indie things. So Tethered, I think you mentioned in your intro, which is a VR game, and another project with some ex-Media Molecule people called Wonder Worlds, which is a little iOS game, a UGC thing. So very Media Molecule kind of wheelhouse. But yeah, so when Nico got in touch, I wasn't thinking, oh, great, yes, he's getting in touch with me because he wants to hire me as a composer. He was just, as a friend, saying, like, tell me about licensing music. And I just sort of said, it's not quick and it's expensive.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people naively just assume because you're like, especially like knowing that you're not going for like big name artists necessarily, you just, because clearly that's going to cost a lot of money because there's just a cachet associated with that and a price tag. But if you just like got some music you want to license, I think a lot of people assume because it's already been written that it's therefore cheap because commissioning music sounds so like expensive.
Yeah.
And then so licensing should somehow be cheaper, but it just, it just doesn't work that way. So I think when you found out how much it would cost and the time scales are long and actually unknowable basically, it was like, no, that's not got any legs. And he was like, all right, do you want to write the music? And I was like, yeah, cool.
So you had to do a demo. Did you have to do a demo first?
I didn't, and I think, and the reason I didn't have to was the Wonder Worlds project I'd done. If you plug, check out the album on Bandcamp. It's got loads, stream for free, like you don't have to buy it, like, but if you listen to that, three of the tracks are quite sort of synth wavy and have singing robots in them. And I think Nico had heard that and been like, okay. And I don't know whether he'd had that idea previously. He was just checking my stuff out because yeah, he'd been using a lot of Little Big Planet stuff as temp.
Yeah.
And thought, well, might as well, you know, we're using this guy's music as temp, might as well check it out. And I think, yeah, that obviously, and who knows, would that conversation have happened and gone in that direction if I hadn't done that little indie project that had that, just so happened to have done this thing, which was a really great fit for what they were trying to do. We'll never know, but it's one of those nice, I certainly view that as like a happy accident.
Mm. For sure. Did you, was it your idea or was it Nick's idea in terms of using the vocoder or talk box, you know, with the whole Astrobot?
No, yeah. I mean, Nico was definitely into singing robots and the idea of it. So, but yeah, in terms of any specific like music production technique, that would come from me. And it's one of the things I really enjoyed, particularly about Rescue Mission, the first game, was exploring all those different ways of getting singing robots into the music. And so, yeah, it's talk box, which is where it's pretty unpleasant. I only ever did that on one track, actually, the track called A Fire in Your Mind. That's a talk box. So that's a plastic pipe shoved down.
Yeah, in your mouth. Like,
and well, the further you, if you can shove it down your throat, you get much clearer. I guess it's because it's going into the throat cavity. So normally you would just do it in the mouth and like, yeah, in there. But if you can deep throat it a little bit, not a forte of mine, I just like that. But anyway, like, yeah, it's actually quite unpleasant. That's why I don't use it, because it's like, to get it to, and again, as someone who's like, you know, into the production side of things, you want it to sound good.
Yeah.
So yeah, not nice. So that's basically like an analog, really analog way of doing it. So use it relying upon your, the synthesis, sort of filtering of your mouth, your lips, your throat, your tongue, everything. It just sort of piggybacks on top of that. And that's really, it's really cool. But, and I guess the most famous example of that for people would be either some of Stevie Wonder's stuff. He quite often will play a clav or has played a clav through a talk box. It's associated with funk music a lot, actually. But also John Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer intro, that wow, talk box. Gotta love it. And actually, the cheesier the better with me. I love a bit of cheese. And then, yeah, there's the vocoder, which for younger folk, they're just like, oh, this sounds like Daft Punk, basically. that's their point of reference for that. But yeah, again, vocoders is something which any music production nerd is going to have checked out at some point. But they're actually really hard to get to sound good. And a large part of that is, again, that whole articulation thing. If you listen to actually Daft Punk's Random Access Memories album, some of the tracks that feature vocoder, they do it, the ones that are trying to like sing a song, not just the Get Lucky like refrain, but I forget the name of the track. I think it's maybe the George Moroder track, whatever that one's called. That's very... it's very articulate, and the only way they can do that is by not, it's very sparse arrangement in that track, because if you were to fill that out with instruments, you'd stop hearing all the subtlety in the voice. So it sounds cool, but they're actually just hard to get those to work, which I kind of knew. But yeah, so the stuff that's got it in Astrobot, that always takes a long time, like days and days to get that. Yeah, because you can get a really simple sound in minutes that sounds robotic, but it's not, you lose so much of the, if you're trying to sing a song and have lyrics, you lose half of it. Like, it's just not there. So you really got to dig into, there's a lot of manual editing and like mixing and blending in the original vocal performance and stuff, but only for the sibilants and fricatives. And it's just like, it's pain. And then the other technique I use a lot is, text-to-speech, like singing text-to-speech. So when you hear in the I Am Astrobot track, and it's the Astrobot, that's actually text-to-speech, not a vocoder. And that's using a nice little plugin called Chip Speech by Plog, which, again, sounds great, but it's really hard to get it to sound good. So, again, just like, it's a bit of a black hole of fine-tuning to get it to sound good. So,
wow. Well, it sounds amazing. It does sound like somebody was singing it and then you kind of roboticized the voice to the untrained ear.
Yes. Which is good. Yeah. Well, again, it's like just nerdy fun for me to know that stuff. But
yeah. I did want to ask about the remixes you did of the Sony themes. I know you've touched on it before, but how in the world did you get access to the stems? Because I'm assuming it was the stems that you
used. Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't just the full mix, it was the stems. Again, obviously, it's a Sony first party title, and I used to work at Sony, so I know the important people in Sony who sort of would grant these wishes. And so I guess there's a trust thing there. But yeah, I got the multi-track masters for the God of War, Uncharted, and Horizon main themes, which was just awesome.
Yeah, that is awesome. But did the original composers know that you got access to the stems?
I mean, I don't know the definitive answer to that, but I suspect the answer is no, just because from what I saw on Twitter when the game first came out, and I think just because fans were gamers were being like, oh, this is great. Julie Elvin, the singer on Horizon, and Joris de Man, the composer of the main theme, seemed a bit like, what? Cool.
Yeah.
So I guess they didn't know. But I mean, contractually, they don't need to be told. But obviously, I'm not managing those relationships, so I don't know how that all works.
Yeah, but I just found it very fascinating because I assumed they didn't know. And so I was thinking, well, because you know how composers can be very protective of their art, so to speak.
Yeah. They might have been, the other composers might have been told. I don't know. But I don't know them, so.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no like friendly bants.
Yeah. So you took that. Because from what it seems like to me, so say with the vocal stuff in Horizon, with the Horizon theme and the God of War theme, you kit them as is, but you sped them up slightly?
Yes. Yeah. In the case of Horizon 1, a lot. Like, it might even be twice as fast. I can't remember the change in BPM, but again, that's just one of the most simple aspects of getting those themes to sort of work in what is quite an intense experience in Astro Bot. Like, it, you know, the music really helps to push and drive the player experience forward. And like that was non-negotiable, really. Like, speeding it up was and the thing is, we could have sped up and it just not, I might have not been able to find a way to make it work.
Hmm.
In which case, I don't know what the the solution to that problem would have been.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting, like, listening to Julie's vocals sped up. It's like, if you hear that vocal performance sped up on its own, the vibrato is ridiculously fast because it's gone from being, you know, slow and to then just, like, sped up. So, fortunately, there's enough else going on in the track that kind of masks that. If you've got a good ear, you can sort of tune into it and you'll hear it sounds a little bit but yeah, it was just, that was a thrill to just have access to stuff which is, I mean, yeah, it's iconic, so it's sort of got that I've got to play with the crown jewels type sort of feelings, but also just, you know, great performances and brilliant bits of music. Like, there's a reason why those are, yeah, they're the main themes, but, like, you know, they're loved by people, so that also put quite a lot of pressure on the process of trying to, like, you know, you kind of want to be respectful towards it, but you can't be so respectful because it's such a different IP in a different context that trying to translate it over it needed a lot of choppy and being playful, really. And that was the solution to how to get it to work. Is that Astro Bot, fundamentally, it's the number one thing is it's trying to be fun, right?
Yes.
So effectively, the solution to the problem of how do we take serious adult, or a lot more serious and a lot more adult, a non-family-friendly IP, and get to move it into something that is more compatible with Astro Bot was have fun with it. And so that was the sort of green light for me to, creatively speaking, cut up the originals and start playing with it and rearranging little bits and snippets. And I don't know how much of that is clear to the end listener, but It's kind of a, again, it's like quite a 90s sampling aesthetic.
So do you start so with you, the do you start with the drums in that case and try kind of get a groove going?
Normally, so just for a normal track, I often will start with the drums because that is so particularly for sort of that kind of driving electronic music, you do want that to be the core. So I'll often sometimes I'll have a fragment of melody, and then once I've got that kind of going, I then might start bringing drums in again just to sort of start figuring the puzzle out. But for this stuff, it was more a case, the starting point was actually just literally playing with it. And so if you can imagine, I've got, you know, in some cases, I think I can't remember which one, the one that had the most stems would have been God of War, I think. It was just like stemmed ad infinitum. There's loads of stuff in there. And that was just fun from a nerd point of view, music nerd point of view, of just like digging in and be like, oh, I never heard that in the original. I mean, now that I know it's there, I can hear it. But like, you know, you just didn't pick up on these little details. And you're like, okay, so that's a little cool thing. What happens if I cut that up and loop that? And what happens if I, you know, so you'd literally just like tearing it up and rearranging it and just playing with it like as a collage and not worrying too much at that point about trying to retain the identity of the original IP, just literally just playing with it to get creative with it and sort of start to learn it in a way, learn the different parts and what's going on and building up like a mind map of what all the bits are and then just start playing with it. And you get these little, I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like if I take that and pitch shift it, I get like a new chord progression that's not part of the original, but that, yeah, you just sort of just spend days playing about with it. And then I've got all these little sketches at that point of little musical ideas that are these derivative things made from the original. And then it's like, okay, start mashing those together and start to create some form out of it. And quite often that's the stuff you hear at the beginning of the track is the closest to my original experiments, because obviously you've got the build up, you've got a build at the start of a track. So you've got a little element there. So for the Horizon one, it's a little snippet of Julie's vocal that's just like, you get that loop going on. And, you know, so that was like one little experiment. Because like as soon as you get anything that just sounds cool looped, you know, if you had beats to it, it's just going to like, it'll work to some degree. It's like all electronic music. It's the development from an idea that is the challenge rather than just something that sounds cool. That's relatively easy to achieve. And then with the Kratos theme, it's playing around with the vocals.
Well, you did a cool beat drop with the boy. The boy.
Yeah.
Where the music cuts out and it just boy, you know.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, like you have that idea and you're like, nah, I couldn't do that. It's too silly. And then I had a version of the track that was close-ish to the final thing, but not quite done yet. And I just mentioned it to Nico as like, you know, I thought maybe I could drop a little boy sample in there. And he's like, yeah, do that. People will love that. That'll be great. So I'm like, okay, I'll try it. And it's me doing the boy.
Is it?
It is. It's me. It's not the original actor.
Wow.
That was partly.
I never would have known. I think everybody thinks it's the original actor. It's awesome.
I did. Obviously, it's processed. It's also me doing the no in the Uncharted. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yes.
There's a little another, which is obviously that's just the same idea as the boy in God of War, it's trying to find a way to inject a little bit of the main character in
there.
You
could be a voice actor then as well. As no so one would know.
Being a sound designer and having a, yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting stuff. Wow. Just the whole process. Just the whole process of what you go through.
And that's the thing. It's like, that was, and so the other thing to say about that is that that's not the kind of work I normally do. Like, I'm not a remix artist. So, I mean, I am like Mr. Astrobot. So I know that world the best. So I was probably the right person to do that work. But it's interesting that kind of people quite often do covers of, you know, game music. And, you know, people have done some amazing covers of the Astrobot stuff in the last couple of months, which has been blown my mind, really. Just some of it's just great. And that's kind of something that people do. But actual remixes, obviously, because people don't have access to the stems in the way that I did, so it's harder for people to do that. Though I imagine there'll be a lot more of that going on with AI stuff these days, allowing people to extract drums and all this.
If you hadn't have had access to the stems, would you have used an AI program like Moses or Lalal to try and extract the stems?
Not without permission, but with permission, I don't have any problem myself with using that for creative purposes. Why not? And of course, there's a bunch of game music that exists for which there aren't stems, because that's like it's an archival process. It's something that I'm still actually doing just now, just slowly working my way through bouncing out stems for Astrobot, because I'm contractually obliged to do that, because chances are it's not going to be needed, right? But at some point in the future, if someone wants to remix one of the tracks I've done, that's not the point to be asking me to hand over the stems, because my computer won't load those VST plugins from like X years ago and whatever. So you have to kind of just bite the bullet and do it. It's a thing. I haven't used much in the way of any AI processes. I suppose there's some stuff I probably have done in the past. Like there's tools like Melodyne. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's like the guitar. Often thought of as like a vocal tuning plugin, but it has probably 10 year plus years ago now, they added some nice technology to be able to allow you to change the pitch of notes within a mix effectively. And I have at times used that to if I've got a sample which is in a particular harmony and it doesn't fit what I want, I can just change the notes effectively to make it be useful for what I'm writing. I don't know if that's AI based.
I wouldn't think it's AI based, because
it might not be. It might be more just sort of.
It's still a lot of frequency manual analysis
based
with Melodyne, isn't there? Yeah, like with something like Lalal or Moises, which are actual AI stem programs. You basically upload audio and then it separates it automatically.
Spits it
for
out.
You. Yeah.
And I suppose like all AI stuff, it's not whether it works or not. It's the question of what were those models trained on? And is that all kosher and above board? Which, and the answer is probably not.
You get into a bit of a blurry,
For sure. And I think that's one of the things, I think most people are scared of touching any of that stuff, because until all that precedence and legal framework is like nailed down and sorted, you basically can't touch a lot of that stuff, unless you built your own models, of course. So there's nothing wrong with the technology per se, but it's the just the copyright side of things makes it difficult or dangerous at this point to engage. But creatively, I'm into it. Like there's obviously a bunch of downsides to it, but the idea of being able to take stuff and extract things is great. Like that's very attractive to audio people and creative composers that do the kind of music production stuff that I do, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it would be a big tool in, say, the hip-hop world, where sampling is a big thing, right? And I suppose as long as it's used as a tool and it's not outright just plagiarism,
Yes, yeah.
I think it works.
And it's like, I don't know. Okay, I've not heard. I was going to say I've not heard my stuff being done through AI, but I have heard some stuff. Like fans have like run some of my stuff through music generators. Even if it's just like there was someone had taken the lyrics for your GPU and made a metal version of it. And I don't think it was based on musical analysis. I think it was literally just they put the text in for the song and it spat out a metal song with those lyrics. And it was kind of mad. Like it was like, it worked, like all these things, aspects of it were great and aspects of it were terrible, because it's not conceived of in that way. It's just a bunch of random shit, basically. but actually that's, in some ways, that is a creative process in and of itself, because as a sound designer, so much of the best stuff I've ever done, it's all so much serendipities involved. You're messing about with plugins and you're looking for like that little interesting sonic idea to like present itself. And when it does, you're like, I have no idea what just happened, but that's cool. And I know that I want that to be part of this gunch sound or like whatever it is you're working on. And yeah, I love that serendipitous journey of messing about with stuff and getting something cool out of it. And then being able to claim that, you know, yeah, I made that.
Yeah, I made it. It's when, mine.
It's more like you curated it. And I think, yeah, curation and AI go together because that's how you train the models. So like, I think, yeah, there's a whole world of stuff which is going to be really cool there, which, yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it all pans out.
Well, you could create like a Kenny Young sample set, you know, and sell it online if people wanted to, you know.
To go there.
Put a little bit of Kenny in their music, you know.
It's true. I've got enough instruments sitting around here that need haven't been played for a while.
Yeah. Well, I know you use the nickel harper in the
That's right.
Bite of War track, which you'd used in Tethered.
Yep. Yeah. Done your homework. Well done.
I have. Yep.
Oh, it's one of those things where it's like I knew that nickel harper was used in the God of War soundtrack, and it's a Swedish folk instrument. And I just so happened to have bought one to play on the soundtrack for Tethered, and that was based on reference that I received from Alan McDermott, was the audio director on that project, and there was some nickel harper music that he had, which he was like, I think this instrument's great for what we're trying to do because it sounds a bit like it's really clacky, it's these little wooden sort of dowels that you press. That so instead of putting your fingers on the string like a fretted instrument, you put down these little wooden dowels, I think they're called, which just sort of hold on to the string along its length. And so when you press them, they kind of go tick, 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 and then when you let go, they kind of go clunk, 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 clunk. So it's, I think my favorite description of the instrument is it's a bit like a cross between a viola and a typewriter.
It's just like, yeah,
it's clicky clacky, but it's got as a result, it's got such a handmade sound because it's kind of unconventional and clunky, but that really lends itself to anything that you want to feel, yeah, handmade, which again that goes into like the whole like Little Big Planet handmade sound of things.
Yeah.
And I hadn't played it since I'd worked on Tethered, so I was like, God of War, right. We'll get my nickel harper.
But
out.
How do you I don't understand how you go from okay, God of War, nickel harper. You know, I don't see it's just the connection. Like,
it's the Nordic thing. So it's the Swedish instrument, Nordic.
Right. Okay, yeah. Okay, now
it's in there. And then the thing is, the melody I wrote for that, which is the one that goes that's actually kind of bluesy. So it's not a very Nordic like phrase, but it's on the nickel harper, so it's fine for God of War. And I suppose that's the other thing is like. Yeah, so the remixes. If you were to be cruel, you would describe the remix as done as the original themes plus beats, which on some level that is what they are. But like I say, there's this whole other like really long creative process I went through to sort of try and make them more than that. And so each of them do have new parts in them and new melodies that I've put in there. Partly because that's necessary. Like, it's one of the ways to take the serious adult IP and bring it into the kid-friendly world of Astrobot was to, yeah, have fun with it, but also write some tunes that are a little bit more jaunty. And, you know, the God of War stuff is so serious and,
yeah,
like,
it is.
Oppressive. Like, I was like, it's okay, it's a nickel harper, so if I put in this little slightly bluesy riff in there just to make it a bit more, like, comfortable, it just sort of takes chamfers off that war edge, makes it into something a little bit more lighthearted and fun.
So what would be the ratio in terms of you submitting music and Nick approves it? Like, how many times would you have to iterate on a piece of music? Was that common or was it fairly rare?
I'd say it's changed a lot over the course of the project. I think on this project, there was a lot more back to the drawing board. But actually, for most tracks, that's not like, oh, this doesn't work, tear it up and start again. It's more of a, it kind of works, but it's not quite right. And then it's a case of trying to work out what it is that's not working. That can be as simple as tempo. Maybe it's not got quite enough energy. Maybe the tempo drops at some point in the track, because I'm forever always trying to like add shape to things. But then Nico's player experience is like, no, we can't have the music like come down there. We need to just keep that intensity up throughout the level. So there's quite often just a little bit of, again, a very player experience centric feedback and just feeling it and playing it. But yeah, a lot of iteration on this project, trying to get the experience, trying to be as good as we could. I'd say on the first project, Astrobot Rescue Mission, same thing going on there, but I guess less pressure all round. Like, so much less expectation of ourselves and no audience expectation. And so I think in that environment, it's a lot easier just to be like, yeah, I think this is good, yeah. And then it's like, maybe this bit could be a little bit, and you're like, okay, small tweak, job done. There was a lot more sort of faster approval on that project. And if you listen to it, like, there's still some great tunes in there, but actually the production, the arrangements are much simpler. There's generally less going on in the music. It was written a bit quicker, and that's just for those reasons. It's like, okay, that works. Great. Move on. Whereas once we started moving into Astro's Playroom, that project was so much different, because you had this thing of like, it's going to be pre-installed in every PlayStation 5 in the world. So all of a sudden, that's just a different kettle of fish. That's not, okay, this is a small team making their first big game. It's like, okay, there's going to be tens of millions of people checking this out. Basically, that's like pretty much guaranteed. And that's a very strange place to be in. Like, you want that number of people to be playing your stuff, right? But like, to know for a fact that that's going to happen is pretty weird.
Well, what's going to make it even harder is if there's another Astrobot now, because the expectations have risen even more than last time. The pressure on the team and you to deliver.
And the variety as well.
Because you'll be back for another Astrobot, let's be honest. You're so intertwined with the franchise. Now, in the same way like David Wise is with Donkey Kong, or Grant Kirkhope was with Banjo-Kazooie or something. So
Yeah. Which is cool. You know, it's nice to sort of be intertwined with something that people are so into. You know, there's nothing to complain about there.
Yeah, and it's good on the resume as well, right? Yeah, I mean, one of the things I admire about you is the fact that you were contracted and you worked for Sony pretty much, and then you went off and you did freelancing, which is, you don't have the security as you would say if you're actually employed, right? Because you have to find your own work now. And I've always found that a very courageous endeavor, because you don't know where your work's coming from.
Yeah, to start with, like, that was a big sort of. And the thing is, like, you know, Media Molecule was such an amazing place to work, and part of the reason I went freelance was like, because I wasn't interested in moving abroad, because I think there was so many amazing places that, you know, I would love to have worked, but you know, that wasn't something which I wanted or my partner wanted. So I think that there wasn't loads of places in the UK. And also, there's plenty of places in the UK I would love to have worked, but quite clearly, that's just, you can't just be like, hey, got an audio director position for me, guys? Like, that's not a thing. So really, going freelance was, it felt like something that I had to try.
Yeah.
And fortunately, you know, it's worked out, and I've had loads of amazing opportunities and worked on a lot of cool projects. And yeah, I haven't ever had to really like actively knock on doors and being like, oh, I need some work, please.
Yeah.
It's work. I mean, I go to conferences and I meet people and I make sure that I'm sort of reminding the world that of game developers that I exist. Yes, I'm here. I'm available. But you know, outside of that, like, yeah, stuff just has turned up, which is what you want.
Well, of course.
So I haven't had to. Yeah, and I did worry about it to start with, because like, when you have that thing where you're working a project and you know it's going to stop and you don't have anything lined up next, you're kind of to start with, that's incredibly scary. Just like, oh shit, oh shit. And then, but I've learned that actually, I've learned to sort of enjoy that because, you know, working on projects, especially one like this, which is like, you know, I was on it for a couple of years. It's intense writing music day in, day out. Having the idea I've got nothing, and I don't have anything like nothing big lined up at the moment, that's actually just really nice because it means I can just like
take a breather,
chill out. Yeah, take a little breather. And I'm so far things have just turned up, so I'm not currently stressed about it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Because the other thing as well is I think that you mentioned in terms of not moving, obviously, it's a bit of a hassle. But
yeah,
with musicians specifically, you have all these different instruments and stuff. I mean, moving all your gear would be an absolute pain.
Yeah, I never even thought of it in that.
And costly.
Yeah, my wife and I moved from... so Media Molecule were in Guildford, so I was in that neck of the woods in Surrey in England. We moved back to Scotland during the pandemic. And even that was just a mission. You know, I'm with two young kids. It's just like, there's never a good time, basically.
No. Moving's a pain in the ass. Yeah.
Absolutely. So not planning on doing that ever again.
Good man.
ideally. But yeah, I know, like, I've got this nice room. You can see, I hope you can see that there's a door directly behind me, which is not something you get in like normal rooms. Doors are always in the corner, generally speaking. So certainly in a domestic setup. So to have like a proper little sound studio with my weird door is like, it's living the dream. So yeah, this is definitely put down roots.
I did want to ask you, there was a track that you made in Little Big Planet 2, Disco Schmisco. Yep. I'm not sure if you remember.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I think that's my favorite track from LBP 2.
It's an amazing track. Can you just walk me through the process in making that? Because it's so cool. If you remember, it's obviously a long time ago.
I've got two memories of it. One is... So Little Big Planet 2 had this whole... So if the brief for Little Big Planet 1 was... It's like a journey around the world at the highest level for the concept. Little Big Planet 2's closest to that was, it's a journey through science, through the ages, or something like that.
Right.
So you've got like Da Vinci, that's like Renaissance, ye olde science. And then you've got some like new age hippie stuff going on. And then you've got, I guess, what would be like near future, futuristic, kind of slightly more astrobot-y kind of aesthetic, actually. And I don't know if there was a particular level in mind for that track.
So was it something you just wrote and then it was just assigned to a level?
That's what I can't quite remember. Because I think there was a whole bunch of what we called mini games in Little Big Planet 2, which were like non-main path levels that were just like little cool things that some of the designers had made. And I think it was probably just like, okay, we need a kind of higher energy track for that. And I think that might be the level, one of the levels it appears in the original game. I think there's a little shooty spaceship thing or something. Anyway, so I think I was just like something that had a decent amount of intensity for that. And then the starting point, as far as I can remember, was some analog synth. So it's probably the bass line, actually.
Very electronic.
Yeah. So it's just once I got that, and then I think it was the first time I remember a track using, I guess, I don't know what you'd call them. Like I when I put them structure in my DAW, I call them effects, but I don't mean like reverb or delay. I mean like samples that are like risers or lifters or drops or that kind of thing, but I was using like analog synth effects because there's a whole bunch of like type stuff going on in that track. And I don't think I'd really done any of that before and really not really written much to me about electronic music prior to that track. Most of my stuff prior to that was quite acoustic. So if you think of like the pod music from Little Big Planet 1, or like, you know, stuff that had guitars and mandolin and flutes and recorders and all this stuff. That track was definitely super electronic. So it was kind of the, I would say it's one of the first times I've ever done that, really. And yeah, that's, and then the other thing I remember is the, there's an Omnisphere gospel choir patch that is the singers in there. You can do the ha part, and that, and then there's like a little drop in it, and there's something like a snare drum going on. I can't quite remember exactly what happens in the track, but that was me also, again, kind of for the first time experimenting with how to elongate a track, because it's a very common problem for people starting out writing music, particularly electronic music, is you kind of get stuck in a loop because a lot of the music is very kind of like mantric and loopy. And that's great when you're off your head on pills, but doesn't necessarily translate to a great experience in a game. So finding ways to extend an electronic track that doesn't just involve going copy and pasting, so that it actually kind of changes gears for a little bit and goes somewhere else. I think that was me playing with that, because up until that point, and still now, my music is generally, it's in like binary form. So it's just kind of, yeah, just, you know, verse, chorus, occasionally a bridge. There might be a little switcheroo just again to break up the repetition. So there might be like three different sections in there. But I think that was the first time I had done a track, which maybe just had like a little something that was just like a bit different. So in some sort of ways, that track is like a little transition point for me. So it's really weird that you pick up on it, because no one's ever asked me about that track before. So I'm not sure why it means something to you if you just enjoyed it from a little bit.
I just really enjoyed that track.
Yeah, it's funny.
Obviously, when I knew I was talking to you, I went back and listened to you, all of your stuff, and I was like, and obviously I've heard it all before, but then I remember how good that track was. So I was like, oh, I've got to ask him about this.
I always really loved it. Like, I was really proud of it at the time. Just in sort of, I was like, yeah, that's not that it's sophisticated, but it's more sophisticated in terms of those little arrangement and production things than I'd done before. And so I learned a lot from it, and also then got a lot of confidence off the back of it, you know. And so yes, it's an important track in my sort of primordial early writing music career.
Yeah, well, I can see the little nuances of it that kind of influence a little bit of Astrobot, I feel, just like little subtleties.
Definitely, for sure.
I have a couple of questions from the community, so to speak, some Q&A, so hopefully you can answer some of this.
So, first question from Trim the Fat 6354, which is an interesting name. What kind of information are you looking for from a game developer to help you in your creative process?
So there's two areas which, and actually I'm not going to talk about music. Let's just talk about this in terms of game development. I sort of draw a line between game direction and creative direction. And so I'm not talking about job titles here, so it starts to get a bit confusing. I'm talking about and though interestingly, people do tend to be stronger in one over the other. So for me, I'm quite a conceptual thinker. So the thing I care about the most would be the conceptual side of things. So I want to know about where we are, why we're there, the character. I want to know all the detail about like the character's background, any information, little details that can inspire my creative process. So the start of the creative process is the hardest part, because if you can't start, then the rest of it can't happen. So that little nugget of inspiration is super important. And for me, what I'm looking for is like some little creative idea, and not about music, right? Just about place, setting, characters, the environment, anything that can just give me a concept to work with. But then there's stuff that's a bit more utilitarian, like, yeah, what tempo does the music need to be in order to support the game, kind of gameplay that's going on in that level? So yeah, I really want to know what the director I'm working with thinks about that side of things too. Like what are their tastes for yeah, how do you expect me to support this player experience? What is it you need from me? So tempo, intensity, which tempo is part of that, but intensity is like, naively you could think of it as like how loud the track is, but actually it's about how much is going on. Is it a busy track? And things like that are all things that I'm tying to how we want the player to feel when they're pressing buttons, basically. So I kind of view that kind of stuff as a bit more utilitarian, because they're like generally non-negotiables. They're just like, this is what this, it just needs to do that. And then you've got all the conceptual side of things, which, and that's just really a case of some directors I've got really are conceptual thinkers too. So particularly if they're an artist, or if they're maybe got a background in writing, or basically a creative background, they're generally be thinking along those lines too. And they'll, even if they're pulling out their arse and making it up in response to your questions, like, they're just, because they are the director, them making up is completely fine, like, because they know that it's their job to inspire you. So
yeah,
if you're like, what, like, why are we doing this, what's this, and you're like, that doesn't make sense, because I thought the game we were making of was this, so how does that square with that? And then they can be like, oh, well, the reason that works is because of this thing over here. And you're like, ah, okay, I get it. And then you just kind of take that stuff and you channel it into your work. And then failing that, there's always just the throw shit at the wall approach, which is, you know, just you do your best with the information you've got, but sometimes you just don't have enough information and you can't get it because the developer doesn't know the answer to your questions. And that can happen sometimes, particularly
that's
the early
common.
You are in especially the early on in development, where it's not, you don't know what the game you're making is yet. Like when you're super early, which is a bit rare for music, but like when you're super early, you're basically trying to answer those questions and they've not been answered yet. So you do just need to have to throw shit at the wall and try stuff and then be like, all right, let's put it in the game and see. And
see
that will answer questions. And that point, it not working is just as good a result as it working, because you're like, okay, I hope that would work, but it doesn't. So we've learned something from that. So, you know, there's always and it's important to be positive when stuff doesn't work, because otherwise it gets really depressing. But like, you know, you're always just trying to edge a little bit closer to working out what the hell are we trying to do?
Yeah.
And you do need to be a little bit fearless, I suppose, at that early point as well. Just sort of expose yourself to to failure. And that's completely fine. Like, it's part of the process. Yeah. So I don't know if that answers.
I think it somewhat answers.
Trim the fat.
I'm sure 7, 8, 9, trim threes. That fat will be happy with that.
Good.
Next Good. Question. The Red Deft 5319. These interesting names. Any particular inspirations for the music?
In Astrobot, do you think?
Yeah, or? I'm thinking they're talking about Astrobot.
Hmm.
You could just say everything, anything and everything. Everything is inspiration.
I'm trying to think of like a specific example to,
well,
to
any,
give
any
you.
Any bands?
But I mean, I've got like my own kind of personal taste. Like, I stopped listening to music really when I started being a sound designer. I just kind of chopped that limb off. So again, that's maybe part of the reason why I'm so into retro aesthetics, is like my musical sort of knowledge stops around about 1999, basically. And the only reason I've got any vague idea what's going on at the moment is probably just because I've got kids and the stuff I listen to is trash. I mean, they're like 9 and 5.
That's how, so, you know, you're like, getting old, when your kids are like listening to music and you think it's trash.
Absolutely. Some of it's great, but most of it's not. And actually, weirdly, I often like the worst stuff. What's that thing that they liked a few years ago? Is this the Gummy Bear song? I don't know if you've experienced.
I might have heard it.
The Gummy Bear song. I actually weirdly kind of love it. But again, I think I just admire the fact that it's a complete earworm and it's sort of like, it's like, well done. Well done.
Yeah.
But for Astrobot, I mean, not really. Like, there's an entire pantheon of game music which, in many ways, like, because the Astrobot games are harkening back to classic family-friendly platforming games from the 90s, I don't tend to like directly reference anything because I'm not generally trying to pastiche something or make it sound specifically like a particular bit of music. So I'll tend to do things like use little bits of chiptune instrumentation in the tracks, like, but as a little random little thing, not as like, this is a chiptune track. So I would tend to reference like, yeah, musical sounds rather than like musical notes.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, I'm failing on answering that one. There's
That's
not
right. That's
any
right.
like mega obvious, yes, this is a definite influence on this. Yeah.
Okay. All right, final question before I let you get some sleep, right? Because I know it's getting late there. This is from Romeo Stars. The Gardens from Little Big Planet 1 is the most beautiful piece of music I've ever heard in my life. What were the influences behind it? I think you've spoken about this before.
Probably have, but like it's
like
interesting
because... British influence, wasn't it? Like the British stereotype. Yeah.
Oh, that was the thing, yeah. Which is difficult because... Well, that was my direction. So the basis of that track wasn't written by me. It was written by Matt Clark, who was the main composer on Little Big Planet. But so he wrote a track to start with that was basically a rock, quite classic rock version of I guess it's a public domain tune in an English country garden, which is do 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 do. Do, 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 in an English country garden. And that was kind of off the back of me being like, so yes, although it's not necessarily super obvious when you're playing the gardens level, that is, so the wall is the wall that was in the back garden of Mark Healy, the creative director. So it's like his wall in his back garden, and it was meant to be like the quintessential English summer. And not in the high society, like strawberries and cream, like parasols kind of sense, but just like your average person's summer. So that's why you've got sounds of like lawnmowers and airplanes going overhead in the background ambience. And in the music, I was like, okay, I want this to be, and I'm saying British, but actually I think what I'm saying is is English. What is Englishness in music? And that's actually quite hard to sort of be very specific about. So that's when Matt came back with this rock version of an English country garden, and it was like as a track it was fine, but because it was the first level in the game, it wasn't special. It didn't feel like, yeah, Little Big Planet. Do you know what I mean? It was just like that. If this had been for a later level, we might have been like, okay, it's not our favorite, but actually that's fine. And you do have those moments sometimes, especially when you've got a lot to do, right? You're just like, okay, this is fine. It's for a side quest. It's not a problem. But this was the beginning of the game. It needed to be great. And so it was back to the drawing board on that. And so what Matt then came up with, which is interesting sort of seeing insight into his process, because he then, the chord progression on that is, I guess it's air on a G string. And so he kind of took that, and that was off the back of me talking about, yeah, so even though I was saying that the art direction for it was not polite society, I'm like, so one aspect of English musical culture would be this notion of like class. And so if we can get something that's a little bit like classical music in there, that can represent like the hoity-toity of Englishness. And so then Matt took that idea, and I think was airing a G string. And so that was the chord progression then. And so he was doing all this just like without deep conversation with me. Like I gave him feedback and told him the brief and these concepts that I thought you should work with. And there was no like, how about this? How about that? He was like, okay. He would disappear and come back with something that was, you know, like pretty much finished. And he came back with this amazing track, and it had the amazing flute solo in it. And so he'd brought in this amazing jazz musician, Pete Long, who's played the flute on that. And it's certainly the solo towards the end of the track is totally improvised by Pete. So it's just just great. And so what I then took from, and that, so that that was now starting to feel a lot more special, and I was like, okay, cool, this is really good. There was just a few things that needed to sort of elevate it, and like, for whatever reason, maybe it's because Matt was busy, but I just basically got my hands dirty on it and like added the, so I added the string quartet part. And again, that's just going into that kind of classy hoity-toity
English
bit.
Yeah.
And then I added little synth, wobbly bit. And that's kind of like a 1970s vibe to go into that kind of kids TV, BBC kids TV show thing.
Yeah.
It's the electric guitar part. I think I maybe changed the bass part. And the intro, because we had these in-game stems in Little Big Planet, there was this amazing flute part, but there was no flute in the beginning, so I added like this recorder part to go into that stem. And so just little touches, basically, to sort of make it even closer to what I thought it needed. And so the track's mainly Matt's, like, I'd say it's like 75% Matt, 25% me. And yeah, so that's kind of how that all came about. Came to be.
Yeah.
But I know it's a fan favorite, but it's the one that I think of as being, yeah, it's like, it's something that's like Little Big Planet 1 in a nutshell, is that is that track. And yeah, really, really proud of it. And yeah, it's just a shame it's not been released officially.
Yeah.
The LBP stuff's not out there, so.
Yeah, I know we're going to wrap up, but I do want to ask, did you mix and master the Astrobot album?
Yeah.
Ah, yep. Good man. Because it's brilliant.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's very kind. Thank you for all the kind things you've said today.
All that study and audio work made you a master. But yeah, it was good. I look forward to all your future endeavors and where your career goes. Because it's been amazing.
Me too.
I think Astrobot's going to win Game of the Year, personally. I think it's going to.
You know, it could do. I think, yeah, there's various different award shows out there. So hopefully one of them is aligned with the Astrobot fandom.
It will. It's sure. And you should win Best Soundtrack.
That would be nice. But, you know, I'm normally a bridesmaid at these things. So if I get a nomination, I'll be very tickled. And that'd be lovely.
Yeah. Well, when you win... I'll be messaging you, being like, hey.
You were right.
I manifested this. But awesome. Thank you so much for taking time out. And
oh, no, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been a pleasure speaking to you. So you're on social media. You're everywhere, right? You're on Twitter and
yes,
Instagram.
Yes, I am
and stuff.
At KCM Young, and with the recent Blue Sky sort of
phenomenon
exodus, you can find me, KCM Young, there. I think I'm KCM Young pretty much everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
Just put that into your favorite social media and see if I turn it.
Yeah, you should.
And cool. Don't steal it if I'm not.
Yeah, otherwise we'll have to speak to another Kenny Young about getting
yeah, KCM Young 25438.
Yeah, that's right. Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.